Welcome to Sightseeing Japan, the podcast where we explore the land of gold. I'm Paul Bresson.
And I'm Jason Neeling, and welcome to season 5, everybody.
It's good to be here. I am excited for a new season, Jason.
Absolutely. It's going to be a good one. Got some good episodes picked out. Got a trip planned. I almost have my last hotel booked. I was looking at where I'm going to stay in Hakone, and I can't decide. There's so many options, man.
I'm sure you'll find a good one.
Yeah, I hope so. That one's a little challenging. More challenging than I thought. Anyway, so before we get to today's topic, we're very excited to announce that our itinerary store is finally open. We've created 3 itineraries. We got one for Tokyo, one for Kyoto, and one for Osaka. And they cover all of the essentials that you would want to see on your first trip to Japan. So we spend a lot of time talking about these, right, Paul?
Oh, yeah.
Figuring out how to optimize them so that you can see as much as possible in as short a time as possible. So the Tokyo and Kyoto itineraries are 3 days long each, and the Osaka one is 2 days long. Also want to note that these are fairly aggressive, like you're going to be busy throughout the day. But of course, if you wanted to take things slower, maybe stretch it out. Maybe make the 3-day itinerary a 4-day. Nothing wrong with that. But basically, the idea is that you can put these itineraries on your phone, and we'll guide you through each day. You know, you walk out of your hotel, you pull up our itinerary. Okay, where are we going first? You click on that Google Maps link. It's going to tell you exactly how to get there. It's like for each attraction, you know, we got a little write-up giving you some historical and cultural context. We give you the hours. We tell you how much it costs. Google Maps links for everything. So it's just really easy to get between things. And we made sure that the travel time between things isn't going to be very long. A lot of these things, you can just walk between. That's how well we planned it out. Right, Paul?
Yep.
We also have travel tips, recommendations on what kinds of local foods to look for. We have a ton of links to relevant podcast episodes so you can prepare yourself. Some of these episodes are even basically audio walkthroughs. So you can just show up and we'll talk you through it. We'll tell you exactly what you're seeing. So the itineraries are for sale on our Patreon, but you don't have to be a Patreon member to buy them. Anybody can just go to the website, buy them with your credit card. So if you're interested, you can find the link to the store in the show notes for this episode, or you can visit the Travel Tools page on our website, sightseeingjapanpodcast.com.
One important note is that we found out if you are using the Patreon app on an iPhone, there is a significant upcharge. So we recommend purchasing the itineraries directly from our Patreon website.
Yeah, Apple wants your money, but you don't have to give it to them. To get the best price, yeah, just use a desktop computer or go to the website in the browser on your phone. Like, even that is enough to avoid the Apple fee, which is silly, but it is what it is.
The world's a silly place sometimes.
It so is, man. That's not the word that I usually use when I'm complaining about how the world is, but it is a silly place. Another thing we should mention about our Patreon is we've had this long-standing goal of 50 active patrons, right? We're almost there. We just need like 2 people, like literally 2 more patrons, and we will hit our goal, which will trigger us to start working on a Japanese erotic art episode.
Getting really close.
Yeah, I gotta start reading about it.
Right.
I know there are a lot of resources out there. And I guess after that, we need to start thinking about our goal for 100 patrons, right, Paul?
Yeah.
What are we going to do with that? Do we want Paul to drink a bottle of soy sauce? Do we want Paul to eat a big ball of wasabi? We're open to suggestions.
All involving Paul for some reason.
No, that's just what came to my mind. I don't know.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, let us know if you have any good ideas.
Yeah. So, Paul, I think you had something you wanted to talk about, right?
I have a really important development that's since the end of last season.
What's going on?
I started watching One Piece.
I'm actually really excited to hear about this. That's
yeah.
That's awesome. I mean, I have not seen any One Piece, but of course I've heard a lot about it and I've been very curious about it. And I know you said for a long time that you weren't interested just because of what a huge investment it is, right?
Yes.
So what changed your mind?
Honestly, I watched the live action Netflix adaptation.
Oh, I think I saw you mention that on the Discord.
And I liked it.
Yeah?
It wasn't perfect, but it was a pretty good recreation for an anime world in real life, which is difficult to do.
Yeah, sure.
But the story was good. The characters were great. I found it compelling. I was sold. I was hooked. So I decided I'm going to do it.
Okay.
I might go back and change this, but I started the anime where the Netflix live action left off.
How far in is that?
Like 50, 60 episodes.
Wait, so does the Netflix adaptation start at the very beginning?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask this. Have you read any of the manga at all?
None.
Did you have like any familiarity with the One Piece world at all?
I'd say a little bit just because it's so prevalent. I've seen memes, pictures, all sorts of things. Like, I knew some of the characters,
sure,
but I didn't know much about the lore of the world, other than there were a lot of pirates running around.
Cool.
So I just didn't want to start the anime from episode one and then have to watch 50 episodes of stuff I'd mostly seen already. I was worried I would lose interest.
Yeah.
But maybe I'll go back and watch them if I get really into the anime.
That's cool.
I also had a change of heart, so I was avoiding it for a long time because of the time investment, but now I'm kind of enjoying, you know how you find a really good anime, and then it's like 12 episodes or 24 episodes, and then it's done, and you got to go find the next one?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to have to find the next one for a long time. I'm just going to have something to flip on every day.
Yeah, that's cool. I think, for a lot of media, one thing that can be really nice is where you just get so comfortable with these characters and they start to feel like old friends. And it's like each day you can just tune in and see what they're up to. And it's just like comforting, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like that's part of the appeal of One Piece, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Cool. Well, that's exciting. So you'd recommend it, it sounds like.
Absolutely. I got to figure out, I don't know what the fan name is yet. I'm a One Piecer. I'm a pirate. I don't know what One Piece fans are called. I'm still a noob to this.
That's funny. I was just thinking earlier today, like, you know, we don't have like a name for our listeners.
Oh.
Like
the sightseers.
That's what I was thinking. But it's kind of generic, you know. Sightseers could be just people sightseeing. It's not specific to our podcast necessarily.
Yeah, well, if we get it first, it is.
Sure. Well, since you mentioned that, I guess another thing that came to mind that I enjoyed in our time off was the Shogun series. Did I mention that?
Numerous times.
On the podcast,
though? No. I don't know if you did on the podcast.
I don't know if I did in the announcements episode or not, but I feel like I have to say something about it because it seemed really popular. And for good reason. It's a good show. So the Shogun TV series was based on the Shogun novel, which is based on Tokugawa Ieyasu, the real-life historical character that we've talked about so much. But the story of Shogun, you know, branches off from reality a little bit, even though a lot of the characters in there are inspired by real-life characters. And I'll actually be mentioning that in this episode, too. But, yeah, if you're at all interested in kind of how things went down as Tokugawa Ieyasu came into power, just really interesting seeing some of the details of that. And, like, they're close enough to reality that I feel like you can really get a better sense, at least, of what happened.
I've heard a lot of good things about the costumes and the set design.
Yeah, dude, the sets are amazing, especially the huge, like, expansive views of old Osaka. Oh, it's awesome. Like, we talk about how all these wooden buildings, they burn down and stuff, and, like, of course, Osaka looks nothing like it did back then, but just to see the entire thing like it was, I was really excited to see that.
Speaking of Osaka, I just heard that Osaka was voted one of the top 10 cities in the world to live in.
Cool.
Well, shall we get into this episode, Jason?
Let's do it. What are we talking about?
The city of Kanazawa.
Cool. I like Kanazawa. I spent a day there back in 2016, so I'll have some things to say. I visited a lot of the places we're going to talk about today. But Paul, why are we talking about Kanazawa? Like, what's special about this city, would you say?
I would say the amount of museums and historical attractions is off the chart for a city of this size.
It's got a ton of history, and I'd say it's maybe the biggest tourist city that we haven't yet covered.
I would agree with that.
It's a really good city for your first trip to Japan. If you have a little extra time to explore outside of, you know, the Golden Triangle, Tokyo, Osaka, Kyoto.
And if you're interested in that classic Edo era culture, Kanazawa was one of the cultural cornerstones of Japan during that time.
Totally. It's also very accessible. The Shinkansen can get you really quick. It's got just a lot to offer that you won't find elsewhere. And I also wanted to point out that it's a bit of a gateway to a couple mountain villages, Takayama and Shirakawa-go, which we did a whole episode about. If you wanted to visit those two places, Kanazawa would be a great place to kind of start, and then you can take a bus to one of those places.
Yeah.
That's what I did. I went to Kanazawa for a day. The next morning, got on a bus, went to Shirakawa-go.
Nice.
Yeah.
So a little basic info about Kanazawa. It is the capital of Ishikawa Prefecture, and it's located on the Sea of Japan coast in central Honshu.
Yeah, it's kind of northeast from Kyoto and Osaka, and northwest from Tokyo. It's got a population of about 460,000 people. As for the climate, it has a humid subtropical climate. So it's got hot, humid summers, cold winters with lots of snow. Generally, the temperatures are going to be just a little bit cooler than Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
As for the economy, Kanazawa is a commercial center and transportation hub for Ishikawa Prefecture, which makes sense given that it is the capital of the prefecture. And of course, tourism is also a major industry, as well as traditional crafts, which makes sense given its history. I thought that's really cool. All the traditional crafts are really fun to see.
Yeah.
And a lot of the museums and stuff that I visited there had a lot of great displays of those types of things.
Mm-hmm.
There are also a bunch of universities in Kanazawa.
Want to break down that etymology for us, Jason?
Paul, I would absolutely love to, because there's a really fun story behind this.
This one is interesting.
Yeah. I got a lot of detail. I saw like various versions of the story, and you know, I wanted to find the one that was most in-depth, right?
Okay.
Okay, so the area around modern Kanazawa used to be known as Kaga Province. And there was a dude who lived in Kaga. His name was Imohori Togoro, which means Togoro the potato farmer. Togoro made his living by digging up wild potatoes and selling them, so he had a very fitting name, right?
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, while he's digging up his potatoes, over in Kyoto, there was a wealthy merchant, and this merchant had a dream where he was visited by Kanon. This is a very popular bodhisattva that we've talked about many, many times before. There are tons of temples with Kanon making an appearance. So Kanon appeared to this wealthy merchant and told him to marry his daughter, Kazuko, to this potato guy, Imohori Togoro, of the Kaga region. And the merchant was apparently like, yeah, that sounds great, Kanon. I'm going to do that. So he did. He sent his daughter off to marry this potato farmer. Can you imagine being the daughter? You know, like, what are you doing, Dad? You don't even know this guy. You just like heard his name in a dream, and now I have to go hang out with him and his potatoes? I was supposed to marry another rich guy, you know?
Yeah, go live in his little shack with him.
Yeah. So Kazuko, she did her duty, I guess, and she went over and married Togoro, the potato farmer. And of course, she was worried about how her life was going to go. He's a lowly peasant. She's used to being a rich kid in this big city, right? But when she got there and voiced her concerns, Togoro is like, don't worry about it. The Kaga region has plenty of riches to share. Just kind of enigmatic and mysterious sounding.
Yeah.
Apparently, they also had a rice field because one day a flock of birds came and started eating the rice in their field. So to scare them off, Togoro grabbed the last of their gold and threw it at the birds.
That seems like the last thing you should throw at birds.
Yeah, why not just scoop up some dirt?
Throw some rocks or literally anything but your gold.
I don't know. So Kazuko's like, WTF, dude, we're poor enough already. Like, you're a potato farmer. Why are you throwing away the gold? But he's like, chill, chica.
That's an exact quote. Chill, chica.
Yeah, that's what I read in the story. You like gold so much, you should just come with me to wash these potatoes that I dug up. So she follows him. He goes to the well. He cleans his potatoes in the well. And when she looks down, she sees flecks of gold swirling around in the water.
Oh.
So Togoro is like, told ya, Kaga has plenty of riches to share. Get it? Remember when I said that? I was talking about the gold right here. So apparently they were rich, but she didn't even know it. I don't know. There's just gold all over the place.
That is a really interesting story.
Isn't it?
I would have kind of been like, well, why haven't you grabbed the gold?
Yeah, why don't we gather
like
this,
a rich person?
And squish it together into a giant ball and sell it. Yeah. So anyway, I guess I didn't tie this back to the name of this city, Kanazawa. So the point of the story is the area where they lived became known as Kanazawa, which translates to the Marsh of Gold.
There we go.
And there's even a well at Kanazawa Shrine that was apparently established in honor of this well where Togoro cleaned his potatoes. I guess it's not the same well, but it's in honor of that well, whatever that means.
Okay.
That's pretty fun.
Yeah, that is.
Well, Paul, I think we mentioned in the intro that Kanazawa has a pretty fascinating history. You ready to talk about that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Where do you want to start?
Muromachi period is the oldest significant history I have.
Yeah, me too. So I mentioned in that story, Kanazawa was once a part of Kaga province. And yeah, I got the impression that prior to the Muromachi period in the 1300s, there wasn't a whole lot going on. Apparently, there wasn't a big single ruling clan that governed the area, which is what it was like in most of the country. You know, there were already shogunates at that point, right? There was like a centralized power, but Kanazawa, that area was just kind of outside of that.
Yeah, I feel like it was almost a frontier-like territory.
Yeah.
They weren't all the way north on Honshu yet.
Right, and I mentioned Shirakawa-go. I remember when I visited there and started learning about that history, that was super remote, you know? The way that they developed those farmhouses and stuff there, it was just to survive in the middle of nowhere, basically. They're just stuck in the mountains. There's nobody else around. They just had to kind of figure out how to be self-sustaining.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Kanazawa's not far from that. So, similar sort of situation, I guess. Although, you know, the terrain wasn't quite as inhospitable as in Shirakawa-go.
Yeah.
Okay, so during the Muromachi period, at a national level, Japan was ruled by the Ashikaga shogunate. But as their power waned, Kaga province came under control of the Iko Iki. And we've mentioned these guys before, right, Paul? We talked about them in the Osaka episode, and I think we called them warrior monks. That's how I'd seen them described a lot. But based on the additional stuff I learned about them in this research, it seems like that might be a little bit misleading.
Yeah, it was a lot of peasants as well. They were followers of the teachings of the priest Renyo of the Jodo Shinshu sect. That is also known as Pure Land Buddhism that you may have heard before. They actually became the first group that wasn't a daimyo to rule over any province in Imperial Japan ever. And I think we're the only ones ever after that too, as far as I know.
Yeah, I thought their story was really interesting. So like you said, peasants, I saw that there were some priests and... You know, they had farmers and merchants and lower class samurai. There were samurai involved in this too, but they weren't exactly monks. They're not living in monasteries. They're just followers of this religion, which is why they kind of call them warrior monks, right?
Yeah, it was really a people's uprising.
Yeah. So what they wanted was independence, right? They didn't want to be controlled by the shogunate. They wanted to do their own thing. Essentially, you could describe them as a rebel movement, or like you said, an uprising kind of. So yeah, most cities, big cities that we've talked about, started as castle towns, and the castles were built by daimyo. It's kind of cool to think that Kanazawa was a city that was founded by rebels, and instead of a daimyo's castle, it was just their kind of defensive base.
Yeah, and the town grew up around that. Really unique history there.
Yeah, definitely. So the Iko Iki were in control of the area, the whole province, essentially, during most of the Sengoku period, which is, of course, that warring states period, when there are all these warlords running around trying to kind of take over the whole country. But as the nation was starting to finally unify under Oda Nobunaga, he decided, well, you know, if I'm going to unify the whole country, I got to take care of these rebel groups. So we better send some people out to do something about these Iko-Iki. By the way, I mentioned we talked about the Iko-Iki in Osaka because they also had a base there. And at the same time, Oda Nobunaga was sending people to deal with that group in Osaka. They actually managed to hold out against him for 10 or 11 years.
Yeah. I don't think controlling major territory, but they kind of hold up in their hilltop fortresses for a long, long time.
Wasn't that...
Which were monasteries, I think.
This is just based on my memory of that episode, which was quite a while ago, but that was actually on the hill where Osaka Castle is now, right?
I don't recall.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I'll double check and remove it, I guess, if that's wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's right.
And interestingly, early on in his reign of power, Nobunaga was willing to work with religious groups. He worked with Christians sometimes. He worked with the Portuguese who were trying to convert people. He actually worked with the Iko-Iki, or let them be at least for a while, because it suited his purposes. But eventually, when he was getting closer to total power, he decided he needed to control everything.
Reminds me of a game of Risk. You just use people when you can, when they can be helpful to you, you know? Yeah,
then they start getting powerful, and you're like, oh, now I need to take them down.
Exactly. So, but the group of Iko-Iki and Kanazawa were defeated at this point when Oda Nobunaga went after them, or sent people after them. And the general that defeated them was actually awarded control of the province after that. But then Nobunaga was assassinated. So that stirs things up a bit, and that general was replaced by Maeda Toshie, who is the guy who founded the Kaga domain. And then at the battle of, Maeda Toshie died before the battle of Sekigahara, actually, but at the battle of Sekigahara, his family sided with Tokugawa Ieyasu, who of course won that battle and became kind of the first ruler of a unified Japan in the Edo period. So the Maeda family became even more firmly entrenched in the area at that point and ended up ruling that area around Kanazawa through the Edo period. And this is where I'm going to bring up the Shogun TV show again.
Okay.
Because Maeda Toshie was the inspiration for a character in that show, a pretty major character, Sugiyama. If you remember him, he was part of the Council of Regents. He was the guy that kind of disagreed with Ishido and eventually ended up being killed by Ishido's people, as I recall. But that's not exactly what happened in real life. But also, I mentioned that Oda Nobunaga was assassinated. He was assassinated by a follower of his who betrayed him. That would have been Mariko's dad in the show. So that's what brought so much dishonor to their family. Anyway, just thought that was a fun little connection to the show.
Yeah. So with this extra land that they gained from Tokugawa Ieyasu, Kaga domain was by far the largest and wealthiest domain during the Edo era, outside of the lands directly controlled by the shogun.
Yeah, the Maeda family was super rich. I mean, their wealth and resources at their disposal could have been seen as a threat to the new shogunate, but they wanted to reassure the shogun that they weren't going to be trouble. They wanted to support this new peace, I suppose, or at least protect their family, whatever their motivations were. They decided they wanted to focus their attention and resources on the arts and the development of the city instead of military strength.
I got to give them credit for that. It feels like historically, 9 out of 10 rulers would have tried to amass military power, would have waited for their moment and launched a coup attempt and tried to become the new shogun. But they actually invested in arts and culture.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And I would love to be able to like listen in on those conversations of like, how are we going to handle things now? We got all this land. I wonder how much of it was motivated by
loyalty.
Yeah, how much of it was loyalty and how much of it was all of those little things that the Tokugawas were putting into place to prevent uprisings. Maybe they're just like, you know, they're making it so hard. Whatever, we'll just go in a different direction.
Yeah,
you know?
I had the same thought. Did they think they wouldn't be successful and that's why they didn't try?
Yeah.
Or were they actually loyal? We'll probably never know.
Were they going for a cultural victory instead of a military victory?
Yeah, yeah.
That was a reference to Civ, by the way. That was just for Paul. He's a big Civ guy, right?
That tickled my fancy, Jason. Thanks.
Glad to hear it. So yeah, the Maedas, they did all sorts of stuff. They expanded the castle. They planned out the city. They built a canal. Like, you could easily say that Kanazawa is what it is today because of the Maeda clan. If it weren't for them, it just wouldn't be anything like it is now.
Absolutely. As far as Japanese large cities, Kanazawa has a relatively short history, only going back, 500-ish years.
Yeah.
So most of that was under the control of the Maeda clan.
Yeah, and when they got there, it was basically just a little village, The Iko Iki had their little fort there and stuff, but they turned it from this little village into a huge city. And they were smart about it. Besides pouring money and stuff into the arts or whatever, I got some details on, tactics that they used to make sure that this city was going to be a success.
Oh, let's hear it.
So they brought their samurai retainers into the city. I mean, that's kind of a given, I guess. If you're a daimyo, you bring your samurai with you.
Yep.
So that brings the beginnings of a market. You need people around to create goods and offer services for the samurai.
Yeah, and the samurai were some of the richest people in the domain.
Right. But to support them, you need merchants, you need artisans, you need peasants, you need all of those social classes to make a city. So the Maeda provided incentives to bring more people in. To merchants, they offered tax exemptions. They guaranteed them business. They offered them free land. So then a bunch of merchants come in, and with them, they bring their servants. Then you got even more people. And then, of course, I mentioned the Maeda built the canal. They built out their castle. They had all these construction projects going on. So then you have construction workers, even more customers for the merchants. And then as the city starts growing, and especially just because it's growing so rapidly, other people around in the area start hearing about that. They start seeing that. They start thinking, I can think of a lot of benefits of living in or near a city. There are more goods and services available. The daimyo and the samurai kind of keep the peace. If there's a military presence around, there's going to be less crime, you would think, right?
As long as you don't offend the wrong samurai.
Yeah, yeah. You just got to bow to the samurai. Don't look him in the eye when you pass him on the street. You'll be fine, I don't know. I was reading about kind of how a city gets built, and I thought it was really interesting, and I feel like we haven't talked about it a ton, even though, we're always talking about the Edo period as prosperous and a time of peace. Those are kind of the main things we mentioned, right? But all of that really goes hand in hand with urbanization. It was these cities that made all of that possible. So here's some fun facts for you, Paul. Between 1580 and 1700, the population of Japan nearly doubled. And in that same amount of time, the percentage of people living in towns of more than 10,000 people grew more than tenfold. Everybody's flocking to the cities.
Makes sense. You only need so many farmers to farm all the land that's farmable. And then whoever's left over tends to live in cities.
I suppose.
It's amazing what peace can do for your population size.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. One more fun fact. By 1710, Kanazawa was one of the biggest cities in the country, with a population of around 120,000.
Wow.
By 1710, 120,000.
Pre-industrialization, 100,000 is really impressive.
Yeah. All right, what's next, Paul?
Next, I got World War II.
What about the Meiji Restoration?
I didn't really find much.
Don't worry, I'll take care of it.
Yeah.
All right, so after the Meiji Restoration, when the shogunate ended, Kanazawa became a modern municipality in 1889, and over time it annexed neighboring towns and villages, as was common with a lot of cities in Japan around that time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Talked about that so many times. A city just vacuums up all of the nearby smaller towns.
Yep.
And even though the Maeda clan, that super powerful family, they lost their political power when the shogunate ended. They were no longer in charge, but their legacy still lives on through those traditional crafts and the local culture that you will still see in Kanazawa today. Okay, I'm ready for World War II now.
So notably, Kanazawa was the second largest Japanese city to not be bombed during World War II. which is why so much of this great Edo-era culture survives to the modern day. A lot of districts and buildings that survived here did not survive in other major cities.
So today, Kanazawa is a great place to experience that traditional culture, maybe pick up some pottery. You could see a geisha perform, which is kind of a hard experience to track down.
Yeah, there's not a lot of places you can do that.
Yeah. You could stop at a tea house. They have these traditional tea house districts that we're going to talk about. You could eat some gold. That's one of my most lasting memories, maybe.
Okay.
From Kanazawa, let's say. And we'll get into that. Gold was in that story about the name Kanazawa, and it still plays a very big part in Kanazawa's culture. So I'm excited to get to that.
Yep. Well, let's explore Kanazawa, Jason.
I would love to.
So I'm assuming you took the Shinkansen and arrived at Kanazawa Station.
That's exactly what I did. Wait, was it the Shinkansen?
I was going to ask you that because during my research, I saw that the Shinkansen opened its Kanazawa Station, like, I can't remember, around like 2013 or 2014. And I was like, I wonder if Jason made it by then.
I went in 2016.
Okay.
This was actually on our trip together. Our first trip that we did together to Japan. Right after you left, we were in Kyoto, you may recall. And as soon as you left, I got on a train and went up to Kanazawa. But as I recall, it wasn't the Shinkansen. I think from Kyoto, I took a slower train. And the reason I remember that is because it was full and there weren't any open seats. And it was a very long ride.
Oof.
And it was very uncomfortable until a seat finally opened up and I was able to sit down.
Yeah, that would not have been the Shinkansen because it still doesn't go all the way to Kyoto.
That's what I thought.
It gets closer. Another section opened up a couple of years ago, but it still doesn't get all the way there yet, but it will.
So if you wanted to like go directly from one of the big three cities to Kanazawa, you'd have to go from Tokyo, right?
If you want to take the Shinkansen the whole way. It's actually quicker now from Kyoto.
Okay.
But we can get into that later.
Yeah, we got a section about that later on. But yeah, so I took a slow train. But I did arrive at Kanazawa Station. I remember that. And I think that's a good place to start our exploration here today.
So the first thing to note is right at the east exit of Kanazawa Station is Suzumimon Gate.
Very good.
You guys don't want to know how many tries that took that Jason just cut out. Something about the Z after the Tsu gets me.
It's a tough word. I'll give you that. Definitely.
Anyways, this is a huge gate with massive twisting support pillars that's modeled after traditional drums.
Yeah, the Suzumi is a type of traditional drum.
And it looks super cool.
It does. And I'm sad that I didn't get to see that when I was there. And I don't remember if it was, I mean, I don't think I knew that it was there for one thing, but it might have also been under maybe renovations.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. But yeah, I didn't see it, but it's cool. But I also want to say that another kind of unusual thing about this station is that in most cities, like most of the tourist cities we talk about, it's a really good idea to stay at a hotel right near the main train station because they're usually in a really central location. All the tourist stuff is pretty walkable from there, or you can take the train a couple stops. But in Kanazawa, I'm not going to recommend that. There's not a ton of stuff right around the station. All the touristy stuff is a little bit further east or southeast even. So what I'm going to recommend is maybe you get a hotel a little closer to Omicho Market, which is the first attraction we're going to talk about. Or you could even go a little bit further southeast, stay by the Castle Park.
Yeah, those would both be great spots.
It's not a huge deal, honestly. Like, it's not a long walk from the station over to those places anyway. But, you know, why not save yourself a bit of walking if you're going to spend multiple days in Kanazawa?
Yeah.
And I will say, like, even if you got a hotel right by the station, it's a very walkable city anyway. There are buses if you need help, and we'll talk about those later. But if you're in average shape, you won't have a problem walking around the city to see all the sights. Okay. Omicho Market. What do you got, Paul?
It's the busiest market in town. It dates back to the Edo period. very lively in the mornings, but also a great spot to stop for lunch, with a number of restaurants that specialize in rice bowls topped with local seafood.
If you love seafood, you gotta go to this market. And I, like you said, Paul, I would recommend going in the morning. It's especially lively. They got a bunch of fresh seafood and other things that you can just snack on. You know, you can walk through there and buy little samples of things on skewers or whatever. I remember getting some uni right out of the shell, and it was delicious. And I wish I had eaten more of it.
You could never get enough uni.
That's true.
You're like a connoisseur. We go to a sushi place and you're like, is the uni fresh here today?
I don't ask if it's fresh. I ask if they have it at all.
True.
Because 80% of the time when you go to a sushi place and there's uni on the menu,
they're like, oh, we're all out. Yeah, I've heard them say that to you a few times.
Yeah, yeah. You know, when I was in Tokyo the first time and I went to this market right next to Ueno Station, I saw these giant trays of uni. It was like 2,000 yen. And I was like, what am I going to do with that? You know, like I don't have anything to eat that with.
2,000 yen though, what a deal.
I know, looking back, I should have just bought up like four of those and just shoveled them all into my mouth back at the hotel.
Just go back to your hotel room, you're just slamming sea urchin.
Yeah, stuff is good. Anyway, yeah, go to the market, it's fun. And it's a good way to start the day, you know, get a little bit of energy. You know, they have bread, fruit, veggies, ice cream. They even sell other non-food items like flowers and clothes and kitchen utensils, and it's fun. Is that enough for Omicho? Okay, just south of the market a little bit, you're going to find Oyama Shrine. Now, this shrine is dedicated to Maeda Toshie. Remember that guy?
I do.
He was the guy from the Shogun TV show. The first Maeda lord of the Maeda clan. So this shrine was actually constructed in 1599 by Maeda Toshinaga, who was Toshie's successor, and there's even a statue of Toshie here as well.
What's really unique and impressive about this shrine is its main gate. It has a lot of Western influence because it was designed by a Dutch architect. So at the top levels, it's got stained glass windows, which is extremely unique. And it kind of looks like it's made of bricks rather than more traditional materials.
Yeah, it has a very European look. And I have a picture of this from when I was there. And of course, at the time, I didn't know enough about its history to fully appreciate it. But I remember thinking, oh, this is a really unusual looking gate. It doesn't look very Japanese, you know?
Especially to be that old, most of the European type architecture, you think Meiji Restoration era. But this came much before that.
Yeah, that's true. This gate, actually, the top of it used to be used as a lighthouse.
I saw that. But it used to be in a different spot.
Right. It used to be the entrance to the palace at Kanazawa Castle before it was moved to its current location.
The other thing I found interesting about the shrine is it has a strolling garden, and there's a pond there with a really unique bridge over it. The bridge is kind of just planks of wood, but they look like they were just thrown down there by some giant.
Are they kind of zigzagging through the pond?
Yeah, it kind of looks like they're just scattered. Like, they zigzag all over the place. It doesn't really form one straight walking path.
I actually remember that garden really clearly. Because I guess I did think that the bridge was a little bit unusual, but the other thing that stuck out to me there was they had signs on the trees warning about those giant hornets.
Oh, no.
Those things are scary. Fortunately, I didn't run into one, but I don't want to scare anybody off. I mean, those exist in Japan, but, you know, we've spent a lot of time there and never came across one, right? But I think I've seen multiple signs about them.
Okay.
I don't know. I could go on about those. They're kind of fascinating. They eat bees, but then the bees defend themselves by surrounding the wasp and vibrating their wings so much that it heats the wasp up to a temperature where it dies.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do a Bugs of Japan episode.
Maybe we should, man.
Bug catching is kind of like a rite of passage, like summer thing for children in Japan.
All of a sudden, I'm really excited to do an episode about that. because they got those giant centipedes, they got the giant wasps, they got all these crazy spiders.
Add it to the list.
Oh man, yeah. All right, I'm glad you thought of that. That's really that's a fun one.
Well, shall we move on?
Yes. So
I'm really excited for this next area,
dude. This part is so cool. So from the shrine, we're going to head west into what's called the Nagamachi District. This is an old samurai district, and it's awesome.
The atmosphere here looks incredible.
Yeah.
The cobblestone streets, the small canal, the little shop fronts or resident fronts. It looks like you're walking through old time Japan.
It does. And you know, in other cities, even other historical cities, places like Kyoto and stuff, you hear about the samurai. And when you visit the castles, you might read a lot about samurai history, and you'll see the swords and armor probably. But what is really cool about Kanazawa, I think, is you get a better sense of how samurai actually lived. You can explore the types of homes that they lived in. I mean, yeah, like, it's this little samurai neighborhood, and they have those low, like, earth walls lining the streets. Yeah. They kind of divided up different people's property back in the day.
Yep.
It's really fun to walk around, and there's so many museums and fun little things to take a look at.
Well, speaking of samurai homes, let's go take a look at Kanazawa City Ashigaru Museum.
Yeah.
This one looks really cool because it's dedicated to the Ashigaru, who were the lowest ranked samurai warriors.
Right. So the museum actually has two preserved Ashigaru homes that you can explore. You know, as of course, since they're low-ranking samurai, these places aren't huge, but Ashigaru in the Kaga domain in this part of the country actually had bigger homes than most Ashigaru in the rest of the country. Again, going back to how the Maeda lords, they just wanted to make it a really attractive city. They wanted people to want to move to Kanazawa. So if they're offering really nice-looking places to their samurai, that's a good sign, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting. It shows a little bit of the modesty which the lower class samurai lived by. They're still nice homes, especially by the time, but they're not the villas you would think about maybe that some of the higher rank samurai lived in.
True. But in most of the country, these low class samurai didn't even have detached houses. They would live in like row houses that were kind of all stuck together next to each other.
Yeah.
In Kanazawa, they had these detached houses. They even had their own gardens. So in one of these specific ones that are in this museum, the descendants of the Ashigaru family actually lived in that house until 1994.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
That's wild.
It wasn't always located here, though. They moved it here from somewhere else. But
yeah.
I just thought that's so cool, imagining all the generations living there for that long.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Well, if we want to get a little more extravagant, next up we can take a stop at Nomura-kei Samurai Residence.
Yeah, this is just a couple blocks south of the Ashigaru Museum. And yeah, it's fancy. I mean, this Nomura family, they're pretty wealthy. So compared to those Ashigaru homes, this is, I don't know, I said fancy, right?
Yes.
Is there a better word than fancy?
It's a good word. They have samurai artifacts, pretty decent collection, it seemed. There's a tea room and a garden.
Yeah, the garden was great. I actually saw that in 2003, the Journal of Japanese Gardening listed this as one of the top three gardens in Japan.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's kind of a specific publication, perhaps, but
sure,
in a specific year back in 2003, but still.
You're talking about like home gardens?
I don't know if they had any limitations on it like that, if they were talking about a specific type of garden.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe it's home gardens. I don't know. I just saw it called one of the top three gardens in Japan.
Wow.
I remember it being impressive. They also had samurai armor. I think I saw swords in the residence too. And they have a pretty impressive home altar.
Okay.
You know? Okay, a couple more blocks further south, we're going to find the Kanazawa Shinisei Memorial Hall. And I loved this place too. So this building itself is really cool. It used to be a traditional pharmacy, and the outside is really well preserved. Like, it looks like an Edo-era storefront. You can see exactly what that kind of place would have looked like back then. And then the inside is museum.
Showing off the merchant class lifestyle, along with some local crafts.
The crafts were what really got me. So you know, like we said, it used to be a pharmacy, but the museum isn't just about the pharmacy. It's about the traditional culture of the entire city. And one thing that I was amazed to see is their incredible collection of temari, or handballs.
Ah.
You know what those are, right?
I sure do. You've made a few.
I've made a bunch of them, and it was really fun, and they're just really cool. I don't know. I like them. I just think they're really cool objects. So this tradition goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. People would make these little balls out of kimono scraps and thread. Like, you bundle together some scraps of cloth, you wrap a bunch of thread around it, form it into a perfect sphere, and then they would stitch these incredibly intricate designs into them. Just really amazing stuff. And they have a huge collection here of all different sizes. They had ones that were as big as basketballs.
Wow.
Just insane detail.
I remember seeing your pictures of these.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I looked at those for, 10 minutes, just walking around snapping pictures of every single one of them. They had so many cool ones. They also, I remember seeing flowers made of candy, which was weird.
Okay.
But really, really detailed. They look like real flowers, you know?
That's kind of cool.
Yeah. So they're just like little details about the local culture that you might not expect, you know? And I remember the people working there being super nice too. That, like, I think I was kind of the only person in there, the only tourist. And when I came in, they like asked where I was from, and they gave me some origami as a souvenir and everything.
Nice.
Just super friendly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's across the street from that museum, Paul?
That must be the Maeda Tosano Kamike Shiryokan Museum. I almost kind of got it there.
That was a long one. I'm impressed.
It's a mouthful. And it's dedicated to the Maeda family, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, they were a big deal.
Features more samurai artifacts, including more armor sets, which are always super cool. Did you go to this place as well?
I did. I'll be honest, I did not find this place nearly as enjoyable as the previous place, simply because most of those samurai artifacts are documents, and I can't read.
Can't read them.
The armor was cool, of course.
Always.
But yeah, I didn't spend a lot of time there besides checking out the armor. But it's also not really expensive to get into this place, and I think you can get a combo ticket with the previous place. So if you get that, you know, why not just stop in and take a quick look around?
Makes sense.
Yeah. Ready to cross the river, Paul?
Yes.
So we're going to go further south. We're going to cross the Sai River, where we will find Myoryuji, also known as
Ninja Temple.
Or Ninja Dera.
Although it had nothing to do with ninjas.
It's a good name, though. It draws people in.
Yes. The reason it got its name is because it's full of secret passageways, hidden rooms, and even some traps. Ninja-y stuff, right?
Yeah, it's super cool. Escape routes, hidden defenses. I feel like I read a story about some guy, an American guy somewhere, I think, who basically built his house into a place like this. Just booby traps everywhere.
I heard about a guy who like died from his own booby traps once, I think.
Maybe that was him. That sounds familiar.
Occasionally happens. He was a hoarder too, I think.
Hmm. Well, that makes it sound a little less cool.
It was not cool.
But I always really liked the idea of having secret rooms and passageways and stuff. I've been thinking about that. You know, we've been talking about looking at houses, and I might keep an eye out for like a room where it's like, oh, I can put like a secret door there with a bookcase in front of it.
You got to be careful these days, though, because people will assume the worst. Like, if I found somebody that had like a secret trap door to a room under their garage, I would think they're imprisoning people, right? Like, that's the stories you read in the news.
No, I want it to be like a spy movie where you go in there and the LED lights turn on and then the walls are just covered in guns.
No, well, I'm just kidding. You remember Jeffrey's house when we were kids that had the bookcase that flung open?
You mean in the theater kind of room?
Yeah, yeah. There was a bookcase that was actually a door that led to a little space behind the wall.
Wasn't that basically just to get at the electronics, though, behind the giant TV and stuff?
Mostly, but it was still really cool.
It was cool. There's not enough room to really build anything too exciting.
Yeah, it wasn't
back
like
there.
A huge hangout room.
But I was kidding about the guns. I don't really care about guns. What I want is a room, maybe like a little hidden bar, a speakeasy in your house.
That'd be cool.
That'd be kind of fun, right?
Yeah.
Or just have some cool plush leather chairs and you can smoke cigars in there or whatever. Good little ventilation system.
Sure.
I don't know. We'll see. I'll figure it out. Anyway, back to Myoryuji, right?
Yeah. So it was built by the Maedas. And the reason it has all this cool defensive stuff is because they were using it as a way around the Tokugawa restrictions on building up military defenses. So they disguised it as a temple, but really it was a military outpost and possible escape route for them if ever needed.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that is really cool.
It's kind of funny in the history section how we were talking about how they were so focused on the arts and culture and pouring all of their resources into that, but apparently they thought, well,
just in case,
we should just have this one place. Yeah.
Yeah. The only downside to this temple is that you need to book a tour.
Right.
And the tours are in Japanese only, though they do give you an English booklet that kind of gives you some info about the stops you're at. So you still can kind of follow along.
Yeah.
But I heard it recommended you book in advance. You might have to wait a long time if you just showed up and tried to get in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's those barriers to entry that prevented me from going there. And I just didn't have time to do absolutely everything I wanted to do in Kanazawa. But
right.
Yeah, I didn't make it this far out that day. You done with the Ninja Temple?
Yeah.
So just west from there, across kind of this main street, we're going to get into the Nishichaya District. So Chaya means tea house. Cha is tea. A ya is a cellar of whatever comes before it. So Chaya, tea house, and then the Nishi part. Nishi means west. So this is Kanazawa's west tea house district. Kanazawa actually has three Chaya districts. This is not the most famous one, but it does look like it has some cool stuff. So we'll talk about it.
Yeah, it's a small and quiet one.
Yeah, and even besides the specific attractions that are in this district, these Chaya districts are just fun to walk through because they have a very distinct look to them. They're all wooden buildings. They're all right up next to each other. Like, even if you've seen the kind of traditional wooden building type stuff, these districts still have a very unique look to them. It's not going to look like the other merchant storefront kind of thing that we were talking about before.
Yeah.
They're very tall. I think that's what I noticed most about them, is like there's this kind of stone street. And then just rising up on both sides are just these long wooden walls, like without many breaks in the middle. Like there might be some narrow alleyways, but it's kind of just a solid block of building.
Nice. So first stop in Nishichaya, since we're on the ninja kick, right?
Yeah.
How about the Ninjabuki Museum?
Or Ninja Weapon Museum.
Yeah.
Did you look at the pictures of this place?
Yo, you know I did.
Doesn't that look awesome?
It looks incredible. So a whole bunch of ninja weapons and armor are on display, and some various other ninja artifacts. But they got the cool stuff. They got the like metal claws, kind of like the Wolverine style.
Yeah.
They've got all the scythes that are on chains. I forget what they're called.
Yeah, we talked about those, I think, in the samurai episode.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And we weren't sure how they work, like how you use those exactly.
Right.
I think it's you swing the chain. This is my idea anyway. You swing the chain, you wrap it around the other person's arm or their weapon so they're incapacitated to some extent, and then you rush in and slash at them with the scythe thing.
Yeah.
They also had grappling hooks at this place. They got the caltrops, the little, what's another word for those?
Like the little spiky stars you throw on the ground.
Yeah. They have chainmail.
I saw that. That was really interesting. Because there is some chainmail worked into normal samurai armor sometimes, but like it looked like just full set of chainmail. There's information on ninja lore and history as well.
It's fun stuff.
And they have throwing stars there. There's a little alley where you could throw throwing stars.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's always fun.
Always worth it. If you want to learn more about ninja stuff. I mean, all the ninja stuff, the lore, the armor, the tools. Without going to Kanazawa, you can listen to episode 116. We did a whole episode on ninja. I know you're super excited about this next one, Paul.
It actually looks pretty cool.
It does, right?
But I will say, we still have a bunch of museums to cover. I went pretty high level on a lot of these because there's just so many. We can't talk for 5 or 10 minutes about everyone without being a 3-hour episode.
I just realized how long we've been talking, Paul. I think I'm just too excited about starting season 5. I can't stop myself. I keep going on all these.
So anyways, next up is the Dolls Museum, and it has a fantastic collection of all kinds of Japanese dolls. And I saw rave reviews about the staff. They speak English, they give tours, they're super excited to tell you all about the dolls. Everyone was saying it was a really fun place to go.
It does look fun. And there are a bunch of different types of traditional dolls that all kind of have a different purpose and different stories behind them. Hina dolls, Kokeshi dolls, nesting dolls. I saw some pretty amazing little sculptures too at this place.
Yeah.
I think this is another topic we need to dig into more. I think we should do a dolls episode. I feel like I've mentioned that and you didn't seem too interested, but I think it'd be fun.
Yeah, for a second I was like, did we already do that? I was like, no, Jason brought it up and I shut it down.
That's right.
What happened.
It's one of those, one of the many.
I told you this season I wouldn't shoot any down and you didn't pick dolls, so that's on you.
Yeah, well, we got other good ones.
Oh yeah, we do.
I'm excited about all of them.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, a little further south of the Doll Museum is the Kanazawa Nishichaya Museum. Nishichaya, like I said, the West Tea House District. So Nishichaya Museum, the West Tea House Museum. You can see a geisha guest room. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Sounds like there's not a lot of English here, but it's also free. So why not stop in and just check it out?
Yeah.
All right, so I'm thinking maybe that's enough for one day. That's like day one in Kanazawa. That sound good?
That's fair.
Okay. So let's go to sleep.
We don't have sleep music. Do, 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 do.
Do I need to write a little lullaby for this part? For a little interlude?
Maybe in every city episode, we can just put it in.
We'll see. We'll see if I'm motivated enough to do that. Okay, so we wake up the next day. Let's start at the area south of Kenroku-en.
Sounds good.
And today we're going to start south and move north. Yesterday was kind of north to south.
Yeah.
A little bit west of here.
It was like north to south, a little west. Now we're going to go south to north to a little east, perhaps.
Yeah. So again, there's so many museums in Kanazawa. And this part, just south of Kenroku-en, which is a garden, by the way. We'll get to that.
But these museums are lined up.
So
like
many museums.
One next to each other.
Yeah. So let's zoom through them. I want to start with Ishiura Shrine. It's a shrine, not a museum. But it's pretty cool because it's the oldest shrine in Kanazawa. It dates back 1,500 years.
Yeah.
And apparently, you might see a lot of women there.
Because it's a great place to pray for help finding a soulmate.
Aw. That's sweet. Another reason it's popular with women is
Should I just go loiter like outside the entrance gates, trying to look like cool? I don't know.
It's not a bad idea. Try to be the Prince Charming, you know? Watch for a woman to drop something, and then you can swoop in, and she'll be like, oh, this is it. It's happening.
I should just buy a bucket of flowers and, like, give one to every woman leaving the shrine. Anyways.
As long as they don't see the bucket, you know?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Keep that. Pretend like it's the only flower I'm giving away all day.
Hide that behind a bush or something. But another reason that this place is popular with women is it has a very cute mascot. Kima-chan. Did you see Kima-chan?
Oh, of course. It's a cute little dog wearing a priest hat.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen a shrine with a mascot before, but that's pretty fun.
There's also a Tori Gate Row, which always looks cool.
Yeah. All right. Museums now?
Yeah, let's hit the museum row here.
Okay. We'll alternate. Sound good?
Okay.
Why don't you start?
21st Century Museum of Contemporary Art. Large modern art pieces are on display. What I thought was really cool is that It's a circular building with outward facing glass walls, and it was built without a main entrance on purpose to discourage visitors from approaching art only from one direction.
Oh, I like that.
And it has one of those pools that you can walk under and look up through. But I heard that part of the museum may still be closed due to earthquake damage.
Oh, that's a bummer.
Why did I forget to mention the earthquake in the history section?
When was this?
Like last year.
Oh.
There was a major earthquake in Kanazawa last year.
Oops.
Major damage.
That was an oversight on my part, I guess.
They're still recovering. And they would love, I think, to have you come visit them and spend some money.
Huh. Yeah, I missed that.
I knew about that. I totally forgot to put in my notes for some reason. I don't know what happened. But there it is.
Glad you remembered.
There it is.
I just have one comment about this museum. It has a really cool elevator. Did you see the elevator?
I didn't know.
It's all glass.
Ah.
And it doesn't have an elevator shaft. It's just like sitting on a pedestal and it just gets pumped like up and down.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Look kind of cool. Okay, I'm going to go much faster on this next one. The Ishikawa Prefectural Museum of Art. It showcases art by local artists. Back to you, Paul.
Kanazawa Nakamura Memorial Museum. It's a tea museum with a tea shop that has views of a nice garden. But how did it get the name it has, Jason?
Well, the collection that's displayed at this museum is the collection of Eishun Nakamura, who is the president of the Nakamura Sake Brewing Company. He was a big art fan, apparently, and really into the tea ceremony. So he's got like all sorts of tea paraphernalia. That's the word I'm looking for. He's got tea bowls and tea caddies and tea kettles and tea containers and tea scoops and stuff. Okay.
Next up, Jason.
Sorry, I have a quote from him that I thought was fun. He believed that, quote, art is a treasure of the people. It does not belong to one person, end quote.
Agreed.
And that's why he donated his collection to the city before he died.
Nice.
Yeah. Okay, the National Crafts Museum is dedicated to preserving and promoting Japanese crafts, of course. They have around 4,000 pieces, including ceramics, glass, lacquerware, woodwork, bamboo. I could go on for a while, but I won't. Back to you, Paul.
Next, we got the Ishikawa Prefectural History Museum. Obviously, a local history museum. It has some really cool interactive exhibits, and it's also a place where you can try on ancient costumes.
That sounds cool.
Yeah.
I saw there's not a ton of English here, apparently, but there is a little English guidebook you can get.
Okay.
So you get something out of it, even if you can't understand absolutely everything that's going on.
So I know we were going in turns.
Yeah.
But I had one more that I don't think you had in your outline.
Okay.
The Kanazawa No Museum is right here as well.
No Museum?
Yes.
N-O-H?
Yes.
Ah.
So No is a traditional Japanese theater style dating back to the 14th century. And notably, the actors used masks rather than face paint or makeup. And there's a whole bunch of masks on display here. I was actually just the other day listening to our masks episode. And one of the cool things we mentioned is that these masks, depending on the angle you're looking at them, display different emotions. So it sounds like they'd be really fun to go look at.
Definitely. Thank you for mentioning that. Because yeah, I have wanted to look more closely at those masks. They're really interesting.
There's also an actual No Theater very nearby as well.
Cool.
All right, next up, we got the big attraction of Kanazawa.
The biggest attraction in Kanazawa, you think?
If you're in Japan and you tell someone I'm going to Kanazawa, they're going to be like, oh, Kenroku-en.
All right. Yeah, that's probably true, I guess. Yeah.
You want to get started on this one?
Sure, sure. Yeah, so we've been dancing around this huge garden, you know. We've been around the edges of it for a while now. We've been seeing the outer walls of it as we walked around this area with all these museums and stuff. So let's finally get into it. This is one of Japan's three most beautiful landscape gardens. It's in the top three.
But so apparently is that other little garden at the
Well, that was back in that was just a magazine in 2003. They're like, we like this garden, but no, this is like this is a bigger deal than that.
Widely considered one of the top three gardens.
Yeah,
in
like it's nationally famous.
Yeah,
absolutely. So the garden used to be the outer garden of Kanazawa Castle, but it opened to the public in 1871. The name means Garden of the Six Sublimities, referring to these six essential attributes in Chinese landscape theory. So one interesting thing about this garden is that it has a variety of flowering trees that flower at different times throughout the year. So you're going to see very different scenes at different times of year.
Yeah. Different parts of the garden kind of seem to specialize in a different time of year.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very large garden. There's two ponds. There's multiple rivers. There's a waterfall.
It's pretty gigantic. Another noticeable feature, very recognizable feature, I've seen a lot of pictures of these. On the edge of one of these ponds, there are these pine trees. You know what I'm talking about, Paul?
Yeah.
So they got these like big wooden pillars kind of sticking up through the pine trees. And then there are ropes coming down from those pillars to hold on to the branches. So that in the winter, when all the snow is weighing down the branches, they don't they don't break and they don't dip down into the water too.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting to see that.
One thing that really caught my eye here is that there is a fountain that was built in 1632. It uses no pumps. It uses gravity only. And apparently it shoots water up 3 meters high.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I want to talk to the engineer, see how that works exactly. Hard to imagine. Huh.
I want to see that.
Yeah. At the south end of the garden is Seison Kaku, which is a villa that was built in 1863 for a feudal lord's mother. This place has its own garden, and it houses period art and artifacts if you want to see another little museum. So many museums, man. And right next to that is the Kanazawa Shrine, where they have that sacred well that I talked about when we were talking about the potato farmer. So let me share my personal experience in this garden.
Yeah, please do. It was fall.
It was fall. I feel a little bad saying this. It feels blasphemous to say this, but I wasn't super impressed.
Really?
I know. I'm not qualified to do this podcast with this opinion of this garden, I feel like.
Jason is now an enemy of all people from Kanazawa.
I'm sorry. So I was impressed by the size. It was the biggest garden I'd ever been to at that point. Maybe I just got unlucky with the timing. Like you said, I was there in fall, but
it was kind of late fall too.
It
must have been November, because we spent Halloween in Tokyo that year. So it had to have been November.
I guess we did. Okay, well, I don't know what happened. I don't remember seeing a lot of fall colors there, and I also didn't see any flowers blooming. So maybe maybe I just got unlucky with the time. But I don't know. I need to go back, I think. I need to check it out again. And maybe now that I know more about how Japanese gardens work, like this was before we started the podcast stuff.
You can appreciate it more.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Nikko Botanical Gardens. We went in like early spring and nothing was growing yet. I don't feel like I should really like tell people it wasn't good just because I went at the wrong time of year.
Right. I feel like I should just cut this all out. I shouldn't be saying this stuff. I'm sorry, Kenroku, and I'm sure you're absolutely beautiful most of the time. And maybe I just didn't know how to appreciate you properly.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, outside of the garden by the north corner, there's a place I want to talk about that's called Hakuichi Kenrokuen Store. Now, I didn't visit this exact store, but I went to another Hakuichi location. There were a few of them scattered around the city, I think. The place that I went to doesn't exist anymore, but I want to talk about Hakuichi because this is a place where you can get a really fun little treat that's a specialty of Kanazawa, and that is golden ice cream.
I remember your pictures of this.
I was really excited. I think actually a coworker even told me about this. When I told him I was going to Japan, I was going to Kanazawa, maybe he started Googling it and he's like, dude, look at this golden ice cream. And I was like, I'm definitely going to try that.
Yeah.
Sure. It's a little bit gimmicky, you know, but it's a good gimmick. And it does actually connect to the history of Kanazawa, of course. We talked about the gold. And actually, Kanazawa produces 99% of the gold leaf in Japan.
That's crazy.
Yeah. That heritage goes all the way back to the 16th century. So I guess I should describe this gold in ice cream. It's not like the ice cream is infused with gold or anything. They basically just make like a vanilla ice cream cone, but then they take a sheet of gold leaf and wrap it around the ice cream. So you're biting into this gold sheet. Just a really fun experience. I don't know, yeah. Super memorable.
Did you see that this particular store has a tea room completely covered inside and out with gold leaf?
I don't think I did see that.
Because you went to a different location.
Well, yeah, I meant in the research, I don't think I even noticed that. But yeah, the one that I went to was just like a little shop that had the ice cream and stuff.
What really blows my mind is the out. Like, I get the whole inside covered. They did the whole outside too. That's wild.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
They also have a bunch of gold leaf souvenirs and stuff here. And
the gold leaf's not super expensive, right?
It's so thin
that it's like an incredibly small weight of gold.
Right. But it's still very visually striking. And I'm not sure if they actually sell the edible gold there, like the stuff that they wrap around the ice cream. But I remember seeing places all over the city where you could buy little packets of edible gold sprinkles or even little like shapes in gold, like little stamp kind of things that you can peel off and stick on your food or whatever.
That's cool.
Do you remember, Paul? I'm sure when I got back, I fed you some of those gold flakes in a cup of tea or something.
I do remember you bringing that back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was fun. I might even still have some of that.
Really?
Old somewhere. Yeah, I have a drawer of like my Japan souvenirs.
Busted out.
Yeah, that's fun. I just really like all the gold stuff in Kanazawa is really fun to look at. All right, Paul, you're ready to head into Kanazawa Castle Park?
Yes.
So this is right next to the garden. Kanazawa Castle is where the Maeda clan ruled from in the Edo period.
And unfortunately, burned down several times, most recently in 1881.
Mm-hmm.
But they are slowly rebuilding it. And what's cool about it is they're doing it using traditional techniques and materials. So what they've rebuilt is as close to authentic as you can get.
That's cool. I know we talked about another castle where they were rebuilding all the stuff with those traditional techniques too. I think that's a really cool idea.
Yeah. And there's a museum here, but rather than samurai stuff, it's about building castles and all about the construction techniques and all that about
That's
the
awesome.
Castle.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
One thing I want to note, though, is that this castle doesn't have a main keep, and I don't believe they're even planning on reconstructing a main keep.
Was there ever a main keep?
There was at one point, but the original burned down in 1602, and they never rebuilt it. So there hasn't been one ever since 1602.
Okay. It was the Edo era in peace. The Tokugawas didn't really want you building big defensible keeps.
Exactly.
There is a preserved gate and a couple warehouses that did not burn down. So there are a few very old buildings there.
Cool. Yeah, I didn't go into this place.
And there's another garden.
Yep. I remember walking past and looking at it and reading the sign and thinking, do I have time to devote to this? Probably not. Oh, well.
You know, Kanazawa is the gold city. It's also the museum city, but maybe it should be the garden city too. Because I feel like this is like the fifth garden we've come across. Some of the museums had gardens. The samurai residents had gardens. The castle has a garden. And then there's Kenroku-en.
Yeah. I still feel bad about what I said about Kenroku-en. I don't know.
We just have to go to Kanazawa. You got to come back with me.
Okay.
And we'll do it like in spring or something.
There are plenty of things that I missed that I think a trip back is justified.
There's a bit on that coastal area that we can go see outside of the city, I think, too.
Yeah. I mean, we could go all along that coast. There's a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah.
All right, Paul, ready to head north? This is like our last area.
Yep.
We're going to cross another river, the Asano River, to get to the Higashi Chaya District. Higashi means east, and you may recall Chaya means tea house. So this is the east tea house district and the most famous tea house district in the city. The district itself looks a lot like the other one, the same types of wooden buildings, but there are some really unique spots here.
There's the Geisha House Shima, which is a preserved chaya. There's geisha performance rooms preserved that you could look at. There's also the kitchen. I find it really interesting how people were cooking like hundreds of years ago. So that seems kind of cool. But there's also instruments that the geisha used on display and a bunch of other items that they used in their performances.
That's cool. I saw that you can actually look at the owner's living area.
Okay.
And guest rooms and even the geisha's dressing room.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Kind of really see the behind the scenes of how the geisha industry worked.
Yeah.
Just down the street from that is a very special place called Kaikaro. This is the largest tea house in Kanazawa, and it's about 200 years old. It's also still an active geisha tea house. Geisha actually perform there, and I even saw a geisha perform there, and you could too. But I'll get to that in a moment. First, I want to describe just kind of the place itself. It's a beautiful tea house. They have a golden tea room. Like Paul, you mentioned that shop has like a golden tea room. This one has one where the entire interior is covered in gold. I got to peek in there. That was pretty cool. So let me talk about the geisha experience.
Yeah, please do.
Most of the time, tourists don't get to see the geisha. The performances are by private invitation only. It's a very specific process to get invited to a geisha tea house.
There aren't even many geisha left.
I don't remember an exact number, but yeah, they're like so many other traditional industries, they're slowly fading away, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, this place is one of the few places that you, as a foreign tourist, can actually have a geisha experience. Because for a couple months in the fall, on certain nights, they have something called Geisha Evenings in Kanazawa. You can Google that. Geisha Evenings in Kanazawa. And I went to one of these geisha evenings, and it was amazing. So the landlady there, her name is Lady Baba. She's awesome. She comes out, she teaches you all about geisha culture and the lifestyle. Like, she'll answer all of these questions you might have about how geisha live. You know, are they allowed to get married? How does that work? What if they have private relationships? Or like, how do you get invited to a geisha tea house? She goes through that whole process. How does the billing work? You know,
hearing that straight from her sounds really cool.
It was amazing. It was amazing. All these details that like you're not going to find anywhere online.
I saw a lot of pictures of this place, and everybody had the biggest smiles on their face. The performers, the audience, the whole time. It just seems so fun.
They make it super fun. I mean, so like I said, she's teaching you all of this stuff, and then she brings out a couple geisha and they do musical performance. They'll play drinking games with you. Like, it's a interactive thing. You know, it's not just like you watch them perform a couple things and that's it. No, it's like they're doing the whole thing, you know. They're entertaining you in the best possible way.
Did they do a calligraphy performance for you?
I don't recall any calligraphy.
Okay.
But I remember, I don't know, there was this really fun drinking game. I know I talked about it in the geisha episode.
I'm pretty sure.
But I don't know. It was just really magical.
That's so cool.
Yeah, I highly recommend it.
So I know it's a super long episode already, but there's two other places nearby to this district.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
And one of them you're going to love. And I can't believe that you didn't see this place.
Am I slipping in season 5? Am I resting on my laurels?
Well, it's like you had 50 other places included. Kanazawa Phonograph Museum.
Okay.
There's over 500 phonographs and over 20,000 records.
Wow.
And they do sound demos and have a vinyl library. They have an original Edison phonograph.
Didn't Edison have the wax cylinders?
I think that's how they started, yeah. And they also have the first Japanese phonograph ever made.
Oh, man, that is awesome. That's the one that you thought I would be especially interested in?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other one is Kanazawa Yasue Gold Leaf Museum.
Oh, I think I did see that.
It goes over the production of gold leaf and shows off a whole bunch of different gold leaf products.
Yeah.
Those are both really close to here.
That does sound cool.
But I'll leave it at that because we're at like an hour and a half plus already.
Man, now I want to go to Kanazawa. Every time we do one of these city episodes, it's like, all right, next year, I guess we're going
right.
We're going there.
You said you're taking the lead on planning the next one, so it's up to you. There's so many good places to choose.
I try to avoid going back to places I've been, but Kanazawa is a really cool place.
Yeah. So before we go, we should probably talk about getting to and around Kanazawa.
Yes.
We mentioned Shinkansen from Tokyo Station. It's about 2.5 hours.
2.5 to 3, yep.
From Kyoto Station, it's about 2 to 3 hours. If you catch the JR Thunderbird line and take that to the Hokuriku Shinkansen line, you can do it in about 2 hours from Kyoto.
Okay. So if it makes sense for your itinerary, you could also use the JR Pass.
Yes.
Or maybe a better option is the Hokuriku Arch Pass.
Yeah.
That gives you unlimited travel between Tokyo, Nagano, Kanazawa, and all the way down to Kyoto and Osaka. So if you're interested in kind of doing that sort of loop, I mean, that could be a really cool first trip. You know, you hit Kyoto, Osaka, and Tokyo, the big three, but then you also get Nagano, Kanazawa. Maybe you take a bus over to Shirakawa-go or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of taking the long way from Tokyo to Kyoto, but you get to see a whole bunch of really cool stuff along the way.
Yeah.
And it'll be less crowded.
Yeah. So that regional pass, the Hokuriku Arch Pass, is a regional thing that can save you a lot of money in comparison to the nationwide JR Pass, which is honestly pretty expensive these days. It doesn't make a lot of sense for a lot of itineraries. So if you want to link to, I mean, either of those, the regional or the national one, you can check out the Travel Tools page on our website. Look for the links there. Website is sightseeingjapanpodcast.com. Another way that you could save money is you can take a bus from Tokyo to Kanazawa. That's around half the price. It's going to take a lot longer, of course, but maybe you want to do an overnight bus so you can just sleep through it. Then you can even save the money of a hotel for a night, you know?
Yeah.
That could be a cool option.
You could fly.
If money is no object, you could fly.
Komatsu is the nearest airport, about 40 minutes south of Kanazawa.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, that doesn't really...
Depends.
That makes it not worth it.
If you're coming from Kyushu
sure.
or Sapporo or something, it could make sense.
I wouldn't fly from Tokyo because the 40-minute bus ride afterward kind of...
You'd get there faster on a train, for sure.
Train is more comfortable, too.
So once you're in Kanazawa, there is a very convenient Kanazawa loop bus that connects Kanazawa Station with most of these main attractions. And it departs every 15 minutes and runs in a clockwise direction. So you can just hop on and off it all day, keeping on going to the next place.
You could.
Or you could walk.
Yeah. Like I said, I think it's pretty walkable. I didn't find it necessary to use any buses, but even outside of the loop bus, there are other local buses and taxis around if you wanted to use those. Did we make it, Paul? Is that the end?
That's all I got.
All right. Well, I'll be posting pics from Kanazawa on our Instagram, which is at SJP Podcast. Also, be sure to check out our website, which I just mentioned, sightseeingjapanpodcast.com. You can find travel tips, useful links, and of course, our new itinerary store.
Yes.
That's under the Travel Tools page, or you can find the direct link to that itinerary store in the show notes, as I think I mentioned at the beginning. Before we go, a huge thank you to our Shogun-level patrons, Wesley C., Nicholas McKibben, Kevin Harris, Brady K., Jack, Michael Morris, David Imani, Jennifer Crutchfield, Darwin Perrier, Ethan Teague, Yasmin, Sonny Schultz, Jason, Katarina and Ellery, Susan, and Victoria. We are an entirely listener-supported podcast, so it's really you guys that keep us going, and we really, really appreciate you.
Thank you very much.
Paul, what's up next time?
We're going to be talking all about Natto.
Natto.
Everybody's favorite or least favorite food. You can't be neutral on natto.
It's a little bit
of it or you hate it.
It's an acquired taste, we'll say. That's what everybody seems to say about
right.
That'll be fun, I think. Natto has a bit of a reputation, and we're going to dig deep, maybe deeper than Paul is prepared for. We'll see.
Oh, I just know the production. Like, how do you make natto? Jason's going to pull out a 20-page document and guide us through.
I'll try to restrain myself a little bit in the next episode. Well, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.